About a week and a half ago, I had the honor of delivering the homily, the annual Community Hospice Memorial Service, which was held this year up at the St. James United Methodist Church in Merrimack, way up on the north end of Merrimack, almost in Bedford. This service, which is organized by Reverend Lynn Robinson, she's the chaplain at the Community Hospice House, it's been an ongoing event in our community for several years. It is primarily for family members, friends, and loved ones of persons in the greater Nashville area who have died in the previous year. But it is open, of course, to anyone who wishes to come and remember and honor someone whom they have lost at any time in the past. The services are hosted by a different church or meeting house each year, and I have participated in them for the past several years, and while I recall that they had been pretty well attended, I wasn't quite prepared for the number of people who came out for this one. The worship space in that host church is about the size of this one, maybe slightly smaller, not by much. And the room was packed to the point that, that people had to stand along the side walls and across the back wall on both the lower floor and up in the balcony. I think it was the largest assembly I had addressed in some time. I'll share later some of what I said. The service was solemn, but in no way morose. It even had an element of celebration about it. And my participating as a Unitarian Universalist, along with my friend Rabbi Mark Finkel, who offered a reading and a prayer, did give the gathering something of an interfaith flavor. I knew some of those in attendance. I'd even conducted memorial services for a couple of the families who were represented. But beyond the content of the service itself, and certainly well beyond anything I had to say, I came away from the occasion really struck by how such a large number of people from so many varied stations in life, from so many religious and spiritual and philosophical paths, how all these people, about 300 of them, had felt a common need to come together and remember and honor someone who had blessed and touched their lives. And they felt the need to do so in a public shared setting, even though I'm guessing that each of the people who were there probably only knew a few of the other folks who were there as well. It wasn't as if it was a single community that gathered on a regular basis. So I think having to face the reality of death is indeed the great and the common human unifier, as this gathering demonstrated so well. I think it's also why we set aside one day of the year, which we designate as Memorial Day. My earliest memories of Memorial Day, if I can take this in an autobiographical direction for a few minutes here, they actually go back to what it was called Decoration Day, which meant a day to decorate with flowers the graves of family members that one had lost. Now, I know the designation of Memorial Day now is primarily directed at honoring lives lost in military service, which is, of course, a right and honorable thing to do, and which is the focus of many of the celebrations and observances that will take place and are taking place over this weekend. But I've always approached the occasion in a broader sense than that, and as the way I first recall it, as a time to remember anyone who has touched and blessed one's life. And when I think back to some of my earliest memories of it, the decoration days that I can remember even had something of a festive air about them in my family, because they also combined with a family reunion or a multi-family reunion. Because what would happen is my father, my mother, my sisters, and I would ride for about an hour from our home near Charleston, West Virginia, out to one of the state's more rural areas where my father had grown up and where many of the families that he had grown up with were still out there. Now, we would call this place a valley. The local term for such a location was holler. That's a word whose origin I never figured out, even though I've heard it all of my life. Well, the families who lived out in this holler would gather on the grounds of a small Baptist church, and various ones of them, at times when they felt it was time to do so, would walk up the hill to this little cemetery up above the church. You can make a movie out of this. They'd walk up to the hill to this little cemetery up above the church and put flowers by the grave of the relatives, and then come back down and join with the others. And at some point, large quantities of food would be brought out, and everybody would just eat themselves about half to death. And more often than not, a kid or two would get sick from the ice cream, you know, and it kind of all went with the territory. I was telling this to someone, I can't remember who, and they said it sounded like an Appalachian version of the Day of the Dead, which, in a way, it really was. And the day was not complete, speaking of what went with the territory, until we all went into the church for some hymn singing and some preaching. I'll make that preaching. Any preacher who happened to be in attendance, and the word preacher was rather broadly defined in this setting, was invited to come up and hold forth for as long as he cared to do so, and was all he's in those days, as long as he cared to do so, or felt that God was calling on him to do so. And one of my coming-of-age experiences took place in that little church the summer I turned 18, and was soon bound for college to prepare myself for the ministry. Somehow, the word got around that the Eddington boy, Gordon's a kid, was fixing to be a preacher himself. Next thing I knew, I was being invited to join the more seasoned preachers on the platform to do a little holding forth of my own, which I somehow managed to do. Now, the theme of much of the preaching that went on in this setting had to do with where we would spend eternity once we met with the fate of those whose graves we'd already decorated up there on the hill. And while I did believe in heaven and hell, and I counted myself among the heaven-bound, since I had been born again and baptized, something held me back from picking up on that topic when it came my turn to take the pulpit. Now, I honestly can't remember anything I said specifically other than it having to do with the need for all of us to lead good Christian lives while we were still alive. Perhaps my hesitancy to speak of heaven or hell was an indicator of where my thinking and where my religious and spiritual path would later take me, or maybe it was just that at age 18, death didn't have a whole lot of reality for me at that time in my life. Whatever the case, I thought of my Memorial Day, Decoration Day sermon from over 40 years ago, a week ago last Tuesday, as I stood behind a pulpit and delivered a short sermon with a memorial theme to it. This one I based on a passage from the writings of the Indian and Hindu philosopher Rabindranath Tagore. One never knows where his or her journey of the spirit will ultimately lead. I certainly didn't when I set off to college to prepare for the ministry. But along that journey, with all of its twists and its turns and its hills and its valleys, death remains the great mystery. And having now officiated, and this certainly wasn't the case when I was 18, having now officiated in just the past 5 months, two memorial services for persons who were slightly younger than I am, it now has a reality and a mystery for me that didn't have nearly so strongly 40 years ago. So how we as individuals and as a society or a culture deal with this mystery can range from the serene to the bizarre with any number of other points all along that spectrum. When I first chose this topic for this Sunday, which was about 6-8 weeks ago, the Teresa Terry Schiavo case was front and center in our news. Thankfully and blessedly, it has now passed from view. But I want to briefly pick up on it, to move in another direction for a few moments now. I want to briefly pick up on it as a topic, as it relates to my larger topic for this morning on dealing with the reality of death. As is often the case when the media gets a hold of a hot-button issue, there were many more complexities and nuances to this matter than generally came across, some of which I can touch on, but none that I can pursue in any great detail. What is known is that 15 years ago, Mrs. Schiavo took a fall in the St. Petersburg, Florida home where she and her husband Michael lived that resulted in severe and by most reliable indications, irreversible brain damage. No foul play was ever alleged or suspected. The diagnosis most neurosurgeons offered for Mrs. Schiavo's condition was that of, quote, persistent vegetative state, meaning a lack of awareness or response to her surroundings. Then a few neurosurgeons suggested she might be in a minimally conscious state. I'm not altogether sure, and no clear definition was ever offered of what minimally conscious state means, except that it might not be quite as dire as a persistent vegetative state. But it was this possible alternate diagnosis that apparently gave Teresa's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Schindler, a thin reed of hope for their daughter and their desire to keep her alive. And this ran counter to her husband's wishes to remove her feeding tube and allow her to die, a move for which he sought and was ultimately granted the legal permission to do so. I cannot fault Teresa Schiavo's parents for wanting to cling to whatever thin thread of hope they thought existed for their daughter. I have officiated enough funerals now to know that how devastating the loss of a son or a daughter, child or adult, is for a parent or parents. And yet neither do I fault her husband for pursuing the course of action that he did, because the tragedy of this case really is that the husband and the parents could not get together on what to do. Had they been able to do so, the name Teresa Schiavo would never have been known to anyone beyond her family and friends. For as was pointed out, and as this case played itself out, decisions to withdraw life-supporting cases like this one are made frequently, and when they are made with the common consent of all involved in the decision-making process, and when the person for whom the decision is being made has clearly in advance made his or her wishes known, then we never hear about them. And we shouldn't, because we have no need to. What happened in this case is the tragedy of the parents and the husband's inability to find common ground became a political nightmare and, in my opinion, a political outrage. When it became apparent that every legitimately legal and judicial avenue that Michael Schiavo pursued and or was forced to pursue was going in his favor, then politics kicked in. The anguish of Teresa's parents, as I saw it, was exploited and exacerbated by various spokespersons from the usual range of religious right organizations, National Right to Life, Focus on the Family, Family Research Council, Traditional Values Coalition, Operation Rescue. They all showed up. And the politicians and lawmakers who feel bound to seek the favor of such groups. The final outcome of this political process, incredibly enough, was a special session of the United States Congress, no less, and the President of the United States making a special trip from Texas to Washington to sign a piece of legislation aimed at halting the judicial process Mr. Schiavo was pursuing, an attempt that soon failed. Well, for all I can say about this episode, I'll leave it at this. It was neither the United States Congress's nor the United States Presidency's finest hour. A sentiment, as it turned out, that we share by a wide range of our nation's citizens. And there were two images from this whole episode that I think proved to be widely troubling, if not frightening. One was the incessant image on our television screens of Teresa Schiavo in the comatose state in which she had been for about a decade and a half. You couldn't turn on your television more than 5 minutes on a news station and not see it. And the other was the specter of the government at its highest levels attempting to intervene in the most personal of human affairs. These combined images evoke the concerns or the fears that many of us carry in thinking about our own passage from this life. One is that we could be in a similar state with no say-so as to what should happen to us. The other concern or fear is the concurrent one that the powers that, well, powers that be beyond our control or desire will have that say-so. So if there's any good to be derived from this most tragic of happenings, it is a critical reminder that we should be as clear as we can, and as the law allows, as to how our passage from this life should be managed by the use of advanced directives wherever possible. And we should also realize that even the most detailed of advanced directives cannot cover every single end-of-life contingency that we might encounter. And so we also need to be very clear as to who we are entrusting such end-of-life decisions to. And we're not in a position to make them ourselves. It was the absence of such a clear directive in the Shiloh case that really caused it to take the bizarre route that it did. So my last word on this matter is my hope that on this first Memorial Day, after Teresa Schindler Shiloh's death, that all of those who were touched and blessed by her life will begin to find some measure of peace. And we'll begin to find their ways of returning to the fullness of living for as long as they are each and all granted time to live. I think, in fact, this is the reason for having time of remembrance in times of memorial, is to honor those whom we have lost and recall ourselves to the fullness of life and living. And in that spirit, I'd like to turn now as a way of moving to the concluding part of my pulling forth for this morning, to the passage from the writings of Tagore that I used in that hospice service. Here it is. Life as a whole never takes death seriously. It laughs, dances, and plays. It builds, courts, and loves in death's face. Only when we detach one individual fact of death do we see its blankness and become dismayed. We lose sight of the wholeness of life from which death is a part. It is like looking at a cloth through a microscope. It appears like a net. We gaze at the holes and shiver. But the truth is, death is not the ultimate reality. Tagore was an Indian poet, philosopher, novelist, essayist. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1913. Born into a Hindu Brahmin family, his writings were among those that greatly influenced the life and work later of Mahatma Gandhi. And in this writing from a collection of works titled Sadhana, he offers an interesting metaphor that I've not come across before, but one that I do like. He says that consider life and death as a piece of cloth, or maybe like the shirt that I'm wearing, or whatever pieces of cloth you have clothing you this morning. Now, from the way we look at the cloth as we generally see it, it appears to be a whole unified piece. But, as Tagore points out, if we were to put any piece of that cloth under a microscope, we'd see all kinds of holes and gaps in it that are not otherwise visible. To see the cloth in this manner, Tagore suggests, is to encounter the individual fact of death. To experience the death of a loved one, a friend, a family member, however timely or untimely the death may be, really is, as he suggests, to be pulled away from the larger fabric of life and forced instead to look into one of the gaps or the holes in the fabric. Now, the gaps, of course, are as real as the holes in the cloth itself. The important thing, and the healing thing I feel, is the ability and the means to see and recognize both. For it is the gaps that cause us to grieve, as we should, as we must. For this is the grief that in time can lead us one back to see the wholeness fabric of life itself. It can lead us back to the time when life again, in Tagore's words, laughs, dances, plays, builds, and loves. That's not always an easy journey. It's one that cannot rush, but it is one that needs to be taken. We have our times of remembrance and our services of memorial and memory in order to both acknowledge the gaps that have been left in our lives and to find ways of looking first through and then beyond the gap and back to that greater unity and completeness that is there in the fabric of life itself. We do this knowing that the fabric of life is ultimately in the hands of that which is greater than ourselves, a force, a presence, a power, however conceived and named, that sustains and nurtures us as we make the move from the gap to the whole cloth. So on this note, I'd like to finish up by recalling the story my friend and colleague Gary Kowalski told that I read earlier. I cannot imagine much, if anything, more devastating than a parent having to cope with the loss of a three-year-old child under the circumstances that Gary describes. And in this case, it gave the father some comfort to return his daughter's ashes to a swiftly flowing river where otters played. It was comforting, Reverend Kowalski recounts, to think of otters swimming and playing there, frolicking in the sun, mostly innocent of the grief we humans have to suffer. Nature was working as it should, keeping birth and death in a balance that changed with the season and evolved through time, but rested on a reassuring dependability that life would go on. So even in a world where three-year-olds sometimes get sick and die, one still might have faith in an order that underlies creation. And Gary finishes his meditation with these words. The natural order does not take away the pain, but it does help us to know that while the world is full of grief, it remains full of wet, splashing animal gladness. The river claims us all, and the river flows on. So long as there are otters, you know that somehow everything may be all right. River claims us all, and the river flows on. That, in a nutshell, is pretty much what I have to offer when it comes to dealing with the mystery of life and death. Unlike those preachers, good persons all, with whom I shared the pulpit in that little church in the Wildwood, or in the Holler, some four decades ago, I can offer no certainties about either eternal rewards or punishments. I only know this. On such weekends as these, over the course of years, out there somewhere in the future, other folk will think of us as we are claimed by the river that will keep on flowing. Knowing that, let this day of remembrance also be a day of commitment and dedication on our parts. Let it be a dedication to bring our energies, our talents, our love, and our desire for a more healed, loving, compassionate, kind, and just world to the fabric of life in which we are each and all entwined for a time. Let us do so in order that the gap we each will in time make in that fabric be one that leaves the cloth of life with a greater measure of wholeness for our having been a part of it. So may our lives, for the times we are yet given to live in, be full of wet, splashing animal gladness. May we laugh, dance, play, and love in the face of our mortality, knowing that our personal mortality is not the final word in the greater life, marvelous and mysterious universe in which we all live and move and have our being. And as life's seasons play themselves out, I find a certain comfort in the simple yet well-stated words of the 15th century British mystic Juliana of Norwich: ring out, bells of Norwich, and watch the seasons come and go. All shall be well again. I know. Closing hymn, number 86. Blessed Spirit of my life. Let's sing that together.